People can be downright vicious when they make comments online. It can take a real toll on individuals. And are we also paying a price as a society? This hour, Online Civility. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll find out how a protest over pink locker rooms quickly turned into an online deluge of personal attacks. Then we'll take a look at the bigger picture and find out why people are so uncivil online, how online communication affects how we communicate across cultures and different groups, and how text-based communication has changed our relationships. We'll also talk about an effort to make the comments section on a blog worth reading. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When people make comments online on news sites, blogs, Twitter, Reddit, BuzzFeed, Facebook, and all over the place, they often seem to feel comfortable saying things they would never say if they were having a face-to-face conversation. Comment threads can quickly devolve into truly vicious attacks. This hour, we'll talk about online civility and incivility. In a few minutes, I'll talk with a researcher who studies our online interactions, and later on, a blogger who's trying hard to make the comments section on her blog constructive. But first, you probably heard something about the Million Robot March in Iowa City a little over a week ago. It was the brainchild of University of Iowa professor Kimber McLeod to protest the fact that the visiting team locker rooms at Kinnick Stadium are painted pink. We are not interested in reigniting that debate today. Instead, we're going to talk about the online response the protest got. And Kimber McLeod is here with me today. Hello, Kimber.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure thing.
Now, you are no stranger to this kind of public protest, public statement, publicity stunt, in some people would say. Mm-hmm. So when you decided to make this protest public and go about it in the way that you did, you knew that there were going to be people who were upset with you, right?
Yeah, yeah, especially because it revolves around college football.
Right. But you were surprised by really the vitriol in some of the online comments, the email, the Twitter, all of these different ways that people could interact through. What shocked you about this?
I guess it didn't surprise me that people reacted negatively or even so harshly. In fact, you know, I was expecting homophobic, you know, insults, which I got, and sexist insults. A lot of the insults, interestingly enough, were very, very gendered, which is interesting given that the university's official position is that the pink locker room has nothing to do with gender. So, yeah, it didn't surprise me. It just depressed me just to realize that, yeah, there are people like that out there in the world, and there are a whole lot of them as well.
Well, can you read me a couple of the comments that you got? Give us an idea of
what some of the things
people were saying. And, of course, these are the ones where people did not swear at you.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff that we can't read on the air. I got a number of emails. So, for instance, you know, I speak for the state of Iowa in saying that we detest you at a molecular level, quote, end quote. Yeah. And, you know, then there are somehow people decided to throw in like insults against mentally handicapped people, you know, implying that I am. So like from Twitter, I don't get it. Is this guy handicapped or what? But yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on. But I think the main interesting theme is that a lot of the insults were quite gendered, and there are a lot of things that I can't read over the air for you all.
Right. Well, and an interesting thing is also the attacks were not just against you, but there's more than one that attacks your mother.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are more than one. Like some people said, oh, did this guy this guy's mom must have breastfed him till he was 16. Yeah, so I guess that relates to the whole gender thing as well. But yeah, there's one particular that stood out as like the most glowingly, screamingly awesome. I say awesome just because I have to keep a sense of humor about this. Otherwise, it would just be completely debilitating because after, you know, hours of reading insult after insult about yourself, it can take its toll. So you have to have a sense of humor. But yeah, here's one of my favorites. I don't know whether your mom is still around, but I seriously doubt that she is proud of your antics and the boy man that you still are, unless she is also a clown freak show as well. She's really disappointed in you.
Now, you say you have a sense of humor about it, and clearly you do. But when you read something like that, how does it feel?
Well, I mean, my mom is still around, fortunately, so it probably would have felt much worse if she wasn't. But yeah, I guess whenever I do one of these sorts of things, and by far this kind of prankish protest, activist protest that I've done here around the Pink Locker Rooms has created the most violent backlash. But yeah, I always am mentally prepared for it. So I go through, I guess it's kind of like stages of grief. So at first, I think it's hilarious that people would get so wound up over something that I spent, in this case, you know, about 3 hours of my time working on over the past 3 months, you know, about the time it takes to watch a football game. But then after seeing, you know, being reminded again that there are just awful homophobic, sexist people out there, it just becomes depressing. And then reading the stuff about yourself, like, yeah. So you go through I go through these multiple stages. And eventually I bounce back into bemusement and, you know, my sense of humor because it's the only way you can survive.
How do you engage with people? Do you respond?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. So in keeping with the idea that I just want to spend – I don't want to waste my personal life dealing with these attacks. Anytime I got an email, I would just simply write back and say, thanks, exclamation point. So the person who wrote me the thing about the mom just wrote back and said, confused, I don't understand what you're thinking me about. and same with Twitter, or I just ignore it. It could easily take over my life, and there's no point in, you know, engaging with the trolls. So I'd rather spend time with my 3-year-old son and my wife.
Well, and now as the hour goes on, we will talk about engaging with the trolls because some people have taken a different approach to that. But I want to bring Rachel Rubel into the conversation now. She's a lecturer in the Communication Studies Department at Iowa State University. She studies how communication technologies affect how we communicate in this day and age. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And Kembra was just reading some of the responses that he got, which really give us an idea of how quickly these online, quote, conversations can devolve into insults and sometimes even threats, often threats, in fact. And that's something that you have studied, is how quickly this can happen. And can you give me an example of some of the things that you've observed?
Yes, I think that especially in topics that are controversial, so certainly gender and homosexuality is something that tends to be highly controversial, especially in online contexts, it's very quick for individuals to take on sides. So they will be representing what they consider to be their group and wish for that message to be heard, and oftentimes it takes a very negative and even harassing type of tone.
And there seems to be sort of this, I don't know, almost a break with reality, an idea that the person that is being attacked is not human.
Yes, exactly. We all interact based on rules and norms. So face-to-face or online, we have particular standards that we use for communication. A lot of times when we are in person, we recognize that when we break those rules, we have consequences for them. So either we harm our relationships, we might receive punishment for them. But in online contexts, we're oftentimes anonymous. So we don't really see the direct consequences for these types of behaviors. So certainly they could be things that someone might want to say face to face, but they recognize that doing so would come with a cost.
Well, I was interested, Kembru, in some of the comments that you got. There are physical threats in some of these. Somebody, I can't find the comment right now, but, you know, basically said a few things about it and said, you know, in closing, I really do hope this guy gets beat up.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, if you were face to face with that person and they saw you,
I think the odds are pretty good that they wouldn't actually want you to get beaten up, because wanting a grown man to get physically beaten is something that a lot of us don't want. But some of the things that we say, Rachel, seem to have such a disconnect with reality.
Yeah, we do go through a process of sort of depersonalization. So sending these messages out into the internet might be directed at a particular person, but we don't necessarily see that person's reaction to it. We don't see the real consequences of that type of those types of messages. And so it's more about sending out the message of disagreement. And that I talked about this idea of wanting to win so that your side is the winning side. So that becomes more important than actually the consequences of what we say.
When you read a threat, Kembru, mm-hmm. I mean, a physical threat, like, you know, I would like to kick you in a very private place, mm-hmm. and things like that. There's so many of these comments.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that scare you?
No, not that particular comment. But I think collectively, yeah. Globally, it does, like, have the cumulative effect of making me worried for, like, my family also. I mean, there are crazy people out there, and they're like, it's been proven from these comments that there are, you know, really crazy Hawkeye fans out there. And when you get people really, when you mix football into the mix and like deep seated, you know, convictions about gender, homosexuality and so on. Yeah, you can get actual violence. So, yeah, it concerns me. But again, all I can do is keep a sense of humor about it, even though it's depressing.
Rachel, with how these comment threads escalate, do we have any way of really kind of rating how people feel with what they say? I mean, are their feelings reflective of what actually gets put in these comment threads?
That's a good question.
I know, it's a hard one.
It is. So with the communication process, we have what we intend to say, and we also have what others interpret from our messages. And so certainly I think that we do what we can to communicate clearly what our emotions are. It's difficult, especially when it's only text-based. So moving away from thinking about the very negative comments that Kembru has gotten, because clearly those are very problematic. A lot of the uncivil behavior we see online is actually unintentional. We don't have the same sorts of nonverbal cues like facial expression or tone or gestures that might allow us to add a bit of feeling to our messages. So very simple messages could come off as very blunt or overly harsh. Now, what we might do, however, and this relates back to the messages that Kembru has been getting, is that because it's text-based, we feel the need to add additional characteristics to the message.
To go over the top to make mm-hmm. an impact. All right, Rachel, we'll continue talking in just a moment. Rachel Rubel is a lecturer in the Communication Studies Department at Iowa State University. And Kembru, thank you. Kembru McLeod is an associate professor of communication studies at the University of Iowa. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about online civility and online incivility. We're also talking about how communications technologies have changed the way we communicate with each other and even impacted our relationships. With me now is Rachel Rubel. She's a lecturer in the Communication Studies program at Iowa State University. She studies how communication technologies affect how we communicate. And we want to focus for a little while on the kinds of comments that get made on news stories. And Barbara King is here with us now. She's a professor of anthropology at the College of William and Mary. Barbara's been blogging for NPR for 3 years now, and she contributes to the Cosmos and Culture blog. Hello, Barbara.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much.
And I know that you have decided to try to make the comment sections on your blog posts more constructive and to interact with the commenters. But can you give me an idea of some of the comments that you saw that made you think I need to get involved?
Yes, well, I write every Thursday at npr.org, and the blog is called 13.7, Cosmos and Culture. And a lot of what I write about is anthropology and animals, but there's a short list of topics that seem to stir up people's ire, and that short list would include, as we've just been talking about, gender, but also evolution, and I find also food, atheism, and so forth. So if I make a comment that, let's say, I want to explain that I think gender, gender identity, gender expression is a spectrum rather than a dichotomy, that we can think beyond just strictly male and female with other genders, people get very angry. This seems to threaten their whole worldview and their perspective about how people either need to be totally male or totally female with no middle ground. And they'll make very rude comments about that, along the lines of what Kembrew was saying. And we also have, of course, the evolution deniers who claim that I'm basically Satan in some form or another, some terrible atheist out to deconstruct the world, and that kind of thing.
When you first started blogging, were you shocked by the comments you were getting?
I did go through a period of surprise. I quickly realized that if I were to describe on some Thursday the results of some fascinating animal behavior study, people would comment in very calm ways. When I moved to talk about things that people do or people believe or the way that people are, yes, it surprised me how, for example, if I talked about diet and what people eat, are people omnivores, carnivores, vegetarians, veganism, if I talked about that in ways related to food and society, wow, people get really upset with me. And I don't know that I expected that at the beginning.
When you started getting those nasty comments, and I mean, there are different news organizations that have decided to interact with commenters in different ways and mediate comments in different ways, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. But when you started seeing those, I mean, I'm sure there was part of you that just wanted to blast back in some ways, but what made you decide that you would engage?
Well, you talked about it earlier on in the hour that the prevailing wisdom is that, you know, don't engage with trolls. But I did think a lot about that. What is a troll? When should I respond? And when should I not respond? And what I decided to think about was, what would my goal be for engaging with rude commenters? And I kind of came up with three. And that's why I started to jump in more. First, I wanted to show that a tit-for-tat strategy is not the only way to go. In other words, if there's a rude comment, there are choices that we make. We don't have to respond with a rude comment. And I found that important, especially because I wanted to recognize that young bloggers, young scientists may read this. The second reason is that sometimes just jumping in as a real human being does act to humanize things. Rachel talked earlier about how sometimes online there are no consequences, there's a sense of depersonalization. Well, I wanted to repersonalize things, jump in and say, hi, I'm the writer, thank you for your comment, I'd like to point out that. And the third reason is that sometimes there's an escalation. Okay, the trolls, you're not convincing, they're still getting angrier, but as a person gets madder, quite honestly, it can be just a little bit satisfying not to participate in that escalation because it kind of makes the other person a little nuts.
Have you had experiences where you've engaged with somebody who was just lambasting you or personally attacking you, engaged with them in a reasonable way, and had a constructive conversation?
Yes, I have. And I certainly would not say that that is the majority of the time, but it's enough of the time that it makes it worth doing. I have had people say, oh, you know, I was really emotional and I went too far. I apologize, which I think is amazing. Now, I have to say that I have not been personally attacked and personally threatened in the way that Kembrew discussed earlier. And I take very seriously that there are comments that upset me greatly. They don't necessarily upset me so much for me personally, but when I write about feminism or transgender people or, for example, a spectrum of gender identities and expressions, or I write about being an atheist, it worries me for the hatred that is expressed towards other people. And what I'm trying to do is not so much deflect comments from me so much as to have the commenter understand that just like I'm a real person, there are real people behind what the commenters may think are abstract arguments.
Have you noticed a difference between the kinds of comments that you get on your blog on the NPR site as opposed to the kinds of comments you get when that same blog post is posted, for example, to Facebook?
Yeah, I do. This took me a while to figure out. The great thing about blogging for NPR at 13.7 is right at the blog site itself, in the comment section right there, there's a community of us. A lot of people are followers of my four co-bloggers who take the other days besides Thursday, and they jump in and they discuss back and forth. And one thing that I found there, one of my favorite things that happens, if there is incivility being expressed by trolls or rude commenters, a lot of times the community will sort of take up the call and say, look, you've gone too far. And then the community sort of develops, co-constructs the conversation. This does not happen at Facebook. I think there's less of a sense of community on Facebook. People come across my writing on Facebook, you know, next to, say, a music video or the latest news about President Obama or something. They're not searching out culture and cosmos and science. So what happens at the Facebook page is that that sense of depersonalization and anonymity absolutely takes over, and the language there is completely different than what I find at the blog itself. It's extremely, sometimes it's quite filthy and quite hurtful. I rarely jump in there. Occasionally I will. Most often I don't.
Well, an interesting discrepancy between the comments on the blog and the comments on Facebook is if you're a registered commenter on the blog, you will get alerts if somebody responds to your comment. On Facebook, when you make a comment on something public like that, you don't get alerts that say somebody else has responded to that. So I can imagine that would make it difficult to get a conversation going.
Yes, and I also just find that it gets away from me because there may be, you know, many hundreds or many, sometimes occasionally, thousands of comments on Facebook. So what I have been thinking is, I also feel that as a woman writing in the area of science and society, it's particularly important for me to show up and deal with stuff. And I choose to do that at the blog because, again, I have found that, and I would like to say this both for, you know, bloggers, but also for people who comment on blogs, I think in all but the most egregious and extreme cases, we collectively do have the power to shape this discourse. It kind of takes all of us, you know, not being afraid to get in there and responding in some way.
We're talking about online civility, online incivility this hour. I'm talking with Barbara King. She's a professor of anthropology at the College of William and Mary. She blogs at NPR.org. She contributes to the Cosmos and Culture blog. And also with us is Rachel Rubel. She is a lecturer in the Communication Studies program at Iowa State University. And we want to hear from you this hour as well. We'd love to hear your comments about online civility, online incivility, some of the things that you've experienced personally, how you think this reflects our society, why you think people feel so free to share these things online when they would never have these conversations face to face. You can join the conversation online, of course. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, or you can do it the old fashioned way. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. And Rachel, there have been a lot of people giving these comments on news sites a lot of thought because, of course, all news organizations have to deal with this. A lot of news organizations have just disabled comments. And, of course, you don't disable comments once you've posted on another social media network. For example, if we have an IPR story, we have no comments on our website. But if we put that up on Facebook, then, of course, you can comment on that story. So it's difficult to entirely get away from it. But a lot of news organizations have decided not to accept comments. There are news organizations that heavily mediate their comments. There are news organizations that really let whatever happens, happens, as long as it's not obscene. Rachel, one of the interesting things, though, is that people have researched how comments shape our perceptions of what is being commented on. And apparently, comments do really seem to matter to readers.
Yes, there is that sense of a conversation that happens about our news. So it's not just as a singular person reading a story and coming up with our ideas about it. We're either talking about what's happening in the world with our family or our friends, Or in online cases, it's the others who have read that story and who have had something to say. So certainly it makes sense that our perceptions of that story would be influenced by what other people have to say about it.
Yeah, I read an article in The Atlantic about, it's called How Comments Shape Perceptions of Sites Quality and Affect Traffic. And this is from just 2 months ago. And it's about the fact that although reading nasty comments, they took different news articles and they showed them to, you know, different groups in a study. And reading the nasty comments afterward didn't change a person's mood, whether they agreed with the comments or not. It did change how they rated the quality of what they had read. And it almost uniformly brought that rating down. I mean, Barbara, when you hear something like that, how does that make you feel about having comments on your blog?
Yes, I read that study, and I have to say it was sobering. It does make you wonder when I, for example, read peer-reviewed science and then summarize it in terms that are public-friendly, I wonder how the discussion that is to some degree out of my control is going to shape the perception of what I've done. The only way that I could really think about responding to that was, again, to redouble my efforts to be present in the discussion, to maybe clarify if someone concludes something that is actually counterfactual. You know, I have the study right in front of me and someone else is saying, but, you know, if we're talking about, let's say, evolution or climate change, climate science, if they say something just strictly false against the text, then I can bring that out and just participate there.
It's interesting. You were talking about the comments on Facebook and being less constructive. I mean, some people say that comment platforms get out of control because of anonymity, that, you know, you can have a false name or whatever. And there are different levels of anonymity on different kinds of platforms. But on Facebook, for the most part, people are not anonymous. So it makes me think that anonymity maybe doesn't have that much to do with this. What do you think about that, Rachel?
Yes, it's true. On Facebook, we might have a sense that we are a bit anonymous in terms of we aren't right there next to another person, but certainly they have our name, they have whatever we've chosen for our profile picture. And so there is a degree of personalization that happens. Certain websites or certain pages on Facebook I've noticed have it set so that their comments are organized by the number of likes or approval that they get. And other comment sites also use this as well. And so it allows for a sense of community monitoring so that most people online want to see productive discussion. They like to see comments that are positively critical if they are critical. And so sites that have allowed for that organizing of comments on such as Facebook does with certain pages helps that conversation to remain productive, whereas those that are more trolling in nature, very just kind of seeking out negative reactions, get pushed down the list a bit.
You know, Barbara, a lot of people talk about political interactions on Facebook and on other sites. And I know that you've had people who have said nasty things in the comment section on your blog say, "I'm sorry, I was over emotional." Have you ever had anybody say, "You know, I will take into consideration what you said, and I may just change my mind"? Do you feel like you actually convince people?
I think sometimes yes, and I think that also goes two ways. Another reason I really love blogging for NPR is that I do learn also from readers. You know, we are focusing in the topic of the program is the negativity, but there's also, when people write back to NPR, there's a lot of expertise. You know, I hear from other anthropologists, from physicists. I hear from people who may not have careers in these areas but read a lot of science or just know stuff. And sometimes I find myself saying, I really better take that into consideration. So I've had it said to me, and I've said it to others, yes.
Now, before we run out of time with you, Barbara, because I know we need to say goodbye in just a moment, I want to ask you if you have advice for other people who want to write about things online, want to get engaged with online communities, but don't want to be abused. I mean, how would you advise people?
Well, I think the first thing is, unfortunately, to have realistic expectations. I'm afraid that part of taking this on and going public about these matters is to steel oneself against what happens and have a sense of humor and let it, you know, roll off. I mean, I'm not talking about cases in which people are seriously threatened or demeaned. That, of course, we cannot let roll off. But in general, to accept that you're out there to make a statement, to own what you're saying. In my case, I try to write a lot about things that I believe really matter in terms of social justice, and then try to be a person to recognize that people do get angry because they care about what you're writing about. They may think I'm stupid or daft on a particular day, but they're there reading what I'm writing. That's a huge privilege. So I try when I can to be generous, and when I can't, you know, I say that too.
Do you need to remind yourself sometimes that the vast majority of people who read your articles are not going to comment at all?
Do I need to remind myself?
Yeah.
No. I am happy for the interaction that I get, and I know that people are reading all of us every day at 13.7, and I'm really, on the whole, I really have to say I'm quite impressed with the community that results. So this is a significant percentage of the time that, you know, things are going well, and that's what I keep in mind.
All right. Barbara, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Charity.
Barbara King, professor of anthropology at the College of William and Mary. She blogs at npr.org, the Cosmos and Culture blog. And Rachel Rubel is here with me. She is a lecturer in the Communication Studies program at Iowa State University. She's staying with us. We'll talk a lot more about how these communications technologies have changed how we communicate in the United States, in our culture today, and even around the globe. Stay with us. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about online civility and with a focus on online incivility because there does seem to be so much of it. Rachel Rubel is here. She is a lecturer in the Communication Studies program at Iowa State University, and you are welcome to join our conversation. Let us know what you think about some of the comments that you see online, how you choose to interact online. Maybe you're someone who likes to jump in there and get into heated debates. Why do you do that? What do you think you get out of it? What do you think others get out of it? How do you think all of these technologies have changed the way you communicate with your family, with your loved ones, with your friends, with strangers? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. And Rachel, I'm curious. We had Craig from Cedar Rapids called in to say that he believes that troll comments are a reflection of our society, how in politics and the media use people. And he says when it's win-lose, everybody loses. So he thinks that this is something that's a reflection of how our society has evolved. We got this from John in Waterloo. He says, you haven't made it until your name is on the job site bathroom walls. This isn't new, but it's the first time some people have encountered it. So, Rachel, is this new? Is this a change in our culture?
I would say no. In a lot of ways, we see problematic behaviors in all contexts of communication. A lot of times it's more private, but certainly we see cases of harassment and bullying that occurs face-to-face as well as online. Online does allow for those comments to be seen. So whereas the negative communication might have been happening behind closed doors, now it's made public. There's a written record of it. We can see it. So it may appear as though there's a lot of it, although the vast majority of communication that is online is very positive and encourages relationships and learning. So, yes, I think that it does reflect something about our society in that we do tend to take these controversial topics and choose a side. And then in terms of discussing it, it can be very difficult for us to really have a good discussion about it with clearly logical types of presentations of our viewpoints.
Right. But the kind of emotional anger, it's just more visible because of this. Jim is on the line in Spencer at 866-780-9100. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, yeah, I go through this sort of thing because, you know, occasionally somebody will just get my ire. And I enjoy using good, you know, solid research. You know, I don't say something that I can't back up. And sometimes that's exactly what they want. It's very frustrating when people automatically will deny whatever resource you choose because they feel it's biased without, you know, really, you know, arguing the point. They don't like that source because it doesn't sound like they do. But I have had some success. I never engage in the low-level bitterness and the kind of language that I see. And, you know, that eases things a bit, you know, because I'm not going to go to that level. I like to point out sometimes that their whole argument, discussion, point of view is completely it's completely diffused often because of that you know that they're revealing that you know they're not thinking logically and therefore their argument seems to be pointless now. But
so do you
the thing that has worked is if I lay down really good references, because now when I just had a problem with somebody who was trying to imply, well, they actually stated that Bill and Hillary Clinton were responsible for smearing Al Gore, his inventing the internet kind of thing. And, you know, when I pointed out the source, the original, you know, I even had the video of the interview and everything, and then explained to him that he was probably being, vulnerable to a lawsuit, you know, that he had maligned the Clintons. He actually removed all of his comments and went away.
Interesting.
And I love it when that happens.
So you feel like getting them to remove a comment is a victory for you?
Oh, that's the best. When they pull down all their comments and just, you know, delete the whole conversation, that to me that's the perfect day.
Jim, do you feel like you convince people to think about it? I mean, I'm in a profession where I'm not permitted to share my opinions online. So I do not engage in these conversations, but I see a lot of them. And I don't see a lot of forward motion a lot of the time. I see people kind of getting entrenched and having the same arguments over and over again. Do you feel like you actually convince people?
I do. I know. I do because, and I will tell you, there are people, there are many eyeballs. And, you know, I'm not afraid of revealing who I am. And I have blogs and I have interested people that, you know, come back to me later. We have a lot of nice conversations from people who are civil and want to discuss things openly without getting angry about it. And just because the hotheads don't necessarily change their minds doesn't mean that somebody doesn't change their mind.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your comment today.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Jim and Spencer, you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Rachel, I want to get back to something that you said clear at the beginning of the hour, and that was the fact that when we communicate in text, a lot of the time, people don't quite get the subtleties of what we're trying to say. There can be a lot of room for misunderstandings. Can you give me some examples of what you were talking about?
Sure. So if someone posts a story or they post an opinion and someone simply writes back, "You're wrong," that could come across as very blunt. It could even come across as very harsh, depending on the person who's reading it. There's all kinds of simple sort of statements that we might make that we don't necessarily think about the way that it could be interpreted and be seen as uncivil. So I think the most important thing we can do is to see our communication online as a conversation, asking questions, asking for clarification, checking with people that you're interpreting those messages in the same way that they intended. Oftentimes when those questions happen, when clarifications are sought, we realize that, in fact, the person who had written something that seemed overly negative, in fact, didn't intend it to be that way at all.
Of course, that was why people invented emoticons, I think, mm-hmm. The little smiley face. But, you know, I noticed this shift when we moved into email communication. I started feeling frustrated because I felt like people didn't always get what I said and I didn't get what other people said. Now I feel like it is tenfold because of text messages. I feel like they are even more devoid of context and subtext and all of that. Do you see that in your research?
It depends on the person and it depends on the conversation. We can effectively communicate via email or text messaging very easily whenever it is task-related types of communication. So we're organizing a meetup or we're sending important information about our work. The problem comes into play when we're talking about more relational types of things, so about our feelings, about our reactions to someone else. And so in that case, yes, a lot of times we don't have the words to accurately convey how we're feeling or what it is we want to express. So we add in exclamation points, we add in emoticons, we add in capital letters, and more we're moving toward adding additional media into those comments. So we can take a selfie of ourselves and send it to the person so they can see our facial expressions, or we might move away from text-based communication to more picture-based or video-based communication with applications like Snapchat.
I find, just on a personal note, that sometimes I feel like I've become silly because I do use so many exclamation points and so many smiley faces because I don't want to be misunderstood. And then there's sort of this divide between professional communication and personal communication that seems to get greater because I don't want to send professional emails that are riddled with exclamation points and smiley faces.
Right. So it requires all of us to be very adaptable with our communication because certainly take a context like email. Even in professional contexts, we might be sending an email as we would have in the past sent a memo or a professional business letter. So in that case, the communication is fairly formal and very professional. In other cases, we're using email as we would if we were having a conversation or sending quick texts back and forth. So in that case, it does become a bit more conversational and it becomes more informal. So leaving out exclamation points or emoticons can allow for a lot of misunderstandings. So for my students, I teach a computer-mediated communication class. I encourage them to really be mindful of their communication and be very conscious of the context and be willing to make adaptations depending on who they're communicating with and what they're communicating about.
Andy is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Andy.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
I wanted to say that I appreciate the distance of digital communication because it does allow you to be a bit more confrontational than maybe you would be in real life. You know, if you're at Thanksgiving and a family member says something you disagree with, you may not want to say something. But if they post the same thing on Facebook, maybe you're more apt to say something about it.
Interesting. So you do feel freer to engage online because you're not looking at somebody face-to-face.
Exactly. You have that distance. You may, you don't want to rock the boat if you're in person, but online there's not the same stigma.
Does the proximity of a major holiday change your willingness to engage online? Like, am I going to be seeing this person in a week?
Right. Yeah, you do have to be careful. And obviously, with any online conversation, you have to be careful that you don't, make somebody too angry and then cause problems.
Interesting. Well, Andy, thank you so much for sharing that perspective.
Thank you.
And Rachel, I guess probably a lot of people feel that way because we certainly do see people putting themselves out there.
Definitely. And so it's important to recognize that, as Barbara was saying, we do create a sense of culture and what's appropriate in each of the spaces that we communicate. So in an online context, it might actually be the norm that we are engaging in debate or argumentation, that actually becomes a safe space for those types of conversations to happen. So it's important for us to recognize that those spaces are important and that they serve a really important function for individuals and allowing for that discussion to happen.
Now, you have done research about sort of this us versus them mentality that leads to a lot of the nastiest comments online. And you've actually conducted research by creating groups that are fairly arbitrary. Can you describe your research just briefly for us?
Oh, I haven't done research this, okay. But a lot of my research is based on these ideas of social identity. So my primary area of research is intercultural communication and especially looking at ways that we might discriminate or be prejudiced toward others. And what we find, and this goes back many decades in social psychology research, that these identities that we have, so it might be based in culture, it might be based in gender, it might be politics or religion, whenever we take on a particular identity or feel we belong to a particular group, we are very motivated then to protect that group. So we might, in situations where we feel that the beliefs or values of that group are being threatened, we might respond in very confrontational types of ways.
Interesting. So there can be a sort of an us versus them mentality, even if this was kind of a more personal discussion, we wouldn't necessarily go there.
Right, exactly. So if we're communicating one-on-one with someone or we're face-to-face, then we see that person as a person who has a variety of viewpoints and a variety of perspectives. Online, we might take on a mentality of I'm a representative of my group and they're a representative of theirs. So that first email that Kimbrew read that I believe they said, I speak for the state of Iowa.
Right.
Right. So this sense of it's not coming directly from that individual person. Instead, it's coming from
the
group. I represent
the entire state of Iowa.
Yes.
Right. So you mentioned earlier that, you know, the vast majority, I think is what you said, of interactions online are positive and actually create an affiliation. Do you want to flesh that out a little bit?
Sure. So we oftentimes focus on this incivility or the negative communication because it certainly stands out, right? We pay attention to it, we recognize it, and we have very strong reactions to it. But people form relationships and maintain relationships and learn new information all the time online. And so it's important to recognize that far more of that is happening than any of this negative behavior, even if it's what's easier for us to say see.
And we were just talking about how the distance allows us to say things to even family members that we wouldn't necessarily say face to face. The fact that we can communicate with family members is incredibly and friends and
yes.
other people is incredibly important to a lot of people, particularly people who are very far away from the people that they want to communicate with.
Exactly. Yes.
So with the students that you're working with, you know, there have been so many worries over the years that, you know, with texting, with different acronyms that people use to communicate, that, you know, kids aren't learning how to spell, they're not learning how to use grammar, they're not going to be able to communicate in the real world eventually. With the students that you work with, I mean, they've grown up in this environment. What do you see as far as their understanding of a different structure for communication in text or in technology and communicating in the real world?
They are wonderfully skillful at it. We have discussions in class about it all the time, and oftentimes they'll talk about how their generation, so my students are, in their early 20s primarily, for their generation, they've learned the appropriate way to communicate online, and they have no issues with it. However, when they are thinking about 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds, then these are the kids that have the problems, that they're the ones
really?
Who are lacking. And
that's
so then we talk about the, you know, things haven't changed so much. You were 15 years old not so long ago. And then we will get into a discussion about that to say that it might appear as though there are changes in our communication. But the fact is that as communicators, we are very adaptable. And if we are mindful of it, we make the adjustments that we need to.
And you also find that many of your students are very cautious about what they post online.
Yes, exactly. So they have learned to be very cognizant of what information they do put online.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much, Charity.
Rachel Rubel is a lecturer in the Communication Studies program at Iowa State University. We've been talking about online communication and communication through new kinds of technologies this hour. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow it's Wildlife Day with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're going to talk about pheasants, turkeys, and other game birds. This is Talk of Iowa.